Hey, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. This week's episode, we are joined by Greg Lehman, or Lehman, as you'll kind of hear in a funny little exchange coming up. This episode is packed with a ton of information on physical therapy, on research, on best clinical practices, and Greg's input into a lot of treatment techniques that work or don't work. It also has a lot of back and forth humor and a lot of, shall we call them, tangents that we go off on. And a lot have been actually cut out because they're a little bit too risque for this podcast. But I'm going to talk all about them on Beyond the Podcast on Periscope. So if you follow me at Therapy Insiders on Periscope, you'll hear all about the stuff that got cut out of this episode. And there was a lot, but a lot was still kept in. So hopefully you're not squeamish or offended easily, because there are some cuss words in this episode. So if you have kids around, they probably don't want to hear this episode, but you do. So without further ado, let's hear a word from our sponsor, WebPT, and then on to Therapy Insiders. Enjoy. Therapy Insiders is sponsored by WebPT, the end-to-end business solution for private practice PTs, OTs, and SLPs, providing everything from documentation and scheduling to RCM services, billing software, and now, drumroll please, outcomes. WebPT's mission is to help rehab therapists achieve greatness in practice, and that starts with education. That's why WebPT hosts a free webinar every month. Join Dr. Heidi Janenga and Charlotte Bonnet on February 26th as they explain why outcome data is crucial to us as therapists to prove our value. To learn more and register, visit webpt.com/value. And wait till the middle of this episode where I ask Heidi why outcomes are so important for the profession moving forward. Also, UpDoc Media is sponsoring PT Pub Night at CSM 2016. Make sure you register and come hang out with us. It's going to be fun. I promise. And now, Therapy Insiders. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders, part of the UpDoc Media family. I'm Dr. Gene Shirokabrod here with Joe Palmer, Dr. Joe Palmer, Dr. Erson Religioso. Guys, how you guys doing?
Good, Gene.
I'm well, Gene.
All right, so I don't know about you, it's pretty freaking cold here in Maryland. Finally, it's winter time after we had like spring and fall time for a crazy long period of time. And I don't know about you, but maybe it's the cold, but I've been reading a lot more, and usually I like to read things that are beneficial to me, like books on psychology and business and marketing. But I happen to have been reading a little bit more research as well. I'm not quite sure why, and doesn't make me that happy.
I'm not sure why.
I'm really not quite sure why.
Why would I read research?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Something's gotten into me. Might be the weather, but I have been reading more research. And Joe and Erson, I consider you learned men, and I know you read a lot of research, Erson. You pump through a lot of it on your blog.
I don't know if I read a lot of research. I feel like I just cherry pick all the articles that support my approach. Isn't that what everyone does?
That's how it should be done.
Yes.
Obviously.
And I discard the ones that don't.
But I feel like research should be fairly objective. Correct me if I'm wrong here, and please jump in. Wouldn't be the first time that you correct me or try to correct me if I'm wrong. Everybody knows that I'm hardly ever wrong. But research should be fairly objective and build towards some kind of conclusion, not to say that it always does. But I don't think it's a big secret that physical therapy doesn't have the greatest quality of research to support a lot of the stuff that we do. That doesn't stop most of us from doing stuff anyway, because patients get better. So I think it was about time that we brought somebody on that has a better idea, or at least a good idea on research as well. and we can talk about it, maybe even a little bit, and see where he gets us. So, Ersin, how about, what do you say, you introduce our very learned guest as well?
I would say our guest is probably a bit more learned than the three of us. He actually is a physio, which tells you that he is not from the States. He's a physio and a chiropractor. So it's kind of like, I imagine if I was a physio and a chiropractor, and I have a couple of colleagues who are, they'd be like these two warring sides. It would depend on where they went to school, but I, you know, is like, it
like the light side and the dark side battling from within?
Yeah. Except for depending on your perspective, I don't know which is the light and which is the dark. And
doesn't matter.
I guess we'll leave it up to our audience to decide.
Maybe but two yeah, light sides or two dark sides.
Could be. Depending on where they went to school. But it is our pleasure to have Dr. Greg Lehman or Lehman. I would say Lehman. On the podcast today. And, you know, I think I've been really excited to have him on. I think if you don't really know him from social media, you should. You should read his blog. Every time he writes a post, it should make you question things. It should, I guess, you know, one of his messages, which is also one of my messages, the more you know, the less we know. And I think we know more about what isn't happening in physical therapy than what is. And he just tends to get a little bit more saltier about it than I do. And I use salty, if I could do air quotes, that's what he would say when I said, you swear a lot. And he just says, yeah, sometimes you got to get salty. Right, Greg?
I must have said that. I don't even remember. Just kidding.
So, Greg, welcome to the podcast. Are you all stretched out, ready to go?
Yeah, I'm all salty, just bathing in it. A little Epsom bath as I'm on here, getting salted up.
There's got to be some research on that, right? Salt's good for you? Good for the muscles?
I think if you apply it with stretchy tape and then scrape it into the fascia is what it does, because then it'll cause the fascia to absorb more water. And that's what the fascia needs. So that's what the salt does. It's just simple osmolarity, right?
That's what I thought. That's what I thought. Yeah. Okay.
Nice. I think that helps the tensegrity of the fascia.
So well, I'm pretty sure, Ersin, when you sell your tools there, like they've been cured in salt water.
Right? I like to say pixie dust, but it's pretty much the same thing. By pixie dust, I mean salt.
That's an awesome next product for your Ersin brand. Edge tools.
Yeah. Brine. Oh, and brine.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that how you pronounce it? I thought it was brine.
Could go either way, like Lehman or Lehman.
Yes,
could. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's an irony. When I started selling those things, I basically was beating the crap out of people. And now people don't understand me when I say you should use the force of a kitten licking you because you're just trying to stimulate skin. And they're like, really? What do you mean? I'm like, literally. Like, just scrape the skin as light as you possibly can.
But yeah, I actually had a kitten on a patient once. I think the statute of limitations is up, but my first clinic was in my apartment in Toronto like 12 years ago, and we were moving, and I lived in the back and had the clinic in the front, and I bought my wife a kitten who's recently passed away. She's in the back here now. Anyways, you don't need that. And there's a patient who I knew really well, and the kitten's supposed to stay in the back. I had my back to her writing notes, and all of a sudden I hear, oh, that feels really nice. And I turn around, and there's Bunny on top of this woman's back, like doing that kitten thing. And she loved it, and I didn't know how to bill for it.
Now, does the breed of the cat change the outcomes? Like, is a certain cat depend on, like, maybe the claws are a little sharper? You know, you could almost be like a needling approach.
That's right.
Well, isn't that the cat scan right? joke?
Oh, well done.
That would be if the cat was assessing.
J.W. Matheson's here.
Well, this episode quickly derailed from the start. To bring us back to research.
Oh, yeah, research.
Cat research. Yeah. At what point, obviously having transitioned from chiro to PT to physio, at what point did you have like this realization or maybe a lack of realizations that you wanted to delve into this, or was it always from the get-go?
I knew before, like before I went to chiro, I did my master's first because I knew I had issues with chiro and I had issues with the PT profession. But back then in Ontario, when you were a physio, you couldn't get direct access. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to go Cairo. But then that's why I did my master's first and then went to Cairo. And Cairo school was great. It was 4 years. The teachers there were excellent. It was just probably too much than you need. But I have probably always identified more with the model of exercise as being the primary treatment, exercise and education. That's what I think physio did well. So then finally I said, forget the Cairo, I'll just go back to physio school.
So how does that, we had somebody ask on Twitter, Andrew Rothschild, at Rothschild PT asked how you balance the research into clinical practice when dealing with, you know, the patient in front of you.
It's a good question. Like you of course, research is a lot of generalization. It'll give you ideas, and everyone is an N of one. So, which is nice. Like like evidence-based practice doesn't mean, oh, there's no evidence for this, so you can't do it, right? So it means that you're allowed to try things. To me, evidence-based practice is more, there's lots of evidence against this. Stop doing things like this. Look to try some other things. It's how I really bounce. It's more when it says what not to do. It's kind of like exercise selection. It probably doesn't matter too much what exercises we choose. It's more probably there's a few that are the wrong ones, and then finding the ones that, you know, you could do 20 other exercises that the patients really want to do. That's more important. So with the individual person, you know, I give people a little bit of slack. Like, you don't always have to have a paper to support it, because you're never going to. Plausibility.
Do you get frustrated? I know. I think that's a great point, that you shouldn't be limited by what might not exist in research. But I feel like reading through some of the conversations that are going on, or discussions or arguments, whatever you want to call them, a lot of times it's people arguing, and it comes down not necessarily to the research, but how ineffective people are at reading and then interpreting the research. Do you ever like just read these arguments and want to bang your head against the wall, that people are just not freaking getting what the research is actually saying?
Yes. I mean, and I think that's just human, where we want to, and Ursa mentioned earlier, just confirm our biases. And that's what we keep running with that. And then we just, you know, it's more talking at the person. It shouldn't, try not to engage in discussions anymore where I don't think my mind could be changed, or I don't think that the person I'm talking to, their mind could be changed, right? There, and I'm sure there's probably some famous quote supporting something like that, but it should be sort of open. So really polarizing debates, I tune out now, and I don't get caught up in like the little details either anymore. It's just the big stuff that I want to discuss. So that's how that kind of helps me engage in life.
I stopped arguing a lot on social media about minutia, and I think a lot of people want to argue about minutia, and it's those conversations that I'm more inclined to block you or ban you from my Facebook page, depending on which social media platform I'm on. It's just circular, and I don't really know what the goal of everyone's arguments are. I mean, I understand that I think healthy conversation is important, but there's a difference between outright trying to convince someone of something that people aren't sure of and that we can't really be sure of. And, you know, like if I already have what I think is sound clinical decision making and decent outcomes, and I've kind of acquiesced to the fact that biomechanics and pathoanatomy plays a little role in pain, I'm kind of done arguing unless the next big thing comes along that makes me go through a strong cognitive dissonance all over again.
Yeah, well, Greg, you made a good point there. I mean, it's really not worth trying to argue with somebody that isn't willing to. Things are always evolving and changing, and somebody that's not willing to bring in new information and critically assess it, it's really not worth arguing with them about anything.
Right. No, for sure. And I also, you want to be a little self-critical as well and think, am I just trying to make a point here to score a point where I don't really care about this discussion either? So I also try to do that. Like, you don't want to just argue for the sake of argue. So I try to think, I'll erase a lot of points when I start writing on Twitter or something or Facebook. Right. What was I doing here? I might be right, but what's the point? Like, right. Am I just, you know, who doing this for? That's the thing as well.
I find I sometimes hold that backspace key down for maybe a minute because I'm like, do I really want to post this? And like, I hold it down. I'm like, wow, this is actually taking a while to delete this message. Let me ask you a question, because I get asked this a lot in my seminars and also online. People will say, hey, you know, I'm kind of all in with using a pain science explanation for the cervical spine, but I still get results and people understand it better for the SIJ. You know, people think that it's out. I use positional based testing and I get results as well. So how do you tell clinicians, even at your seminars, that they got to kind of go all in? That's what I say. You have to go all in. Like you can't just say I use pathoanatomy for the SIJ and not for the cervical spine. You know, like what? How do you explain to patients and also to clinicians? I guess it's a two question.
So there are, I think that there's some patients where it's okay to be a little reticent and not go all in right away because. Say someone comes and sees you. This is an anecdote sort of from Phil Snell, and I'll bastardize it. Like, comes and sees you, and they really want you to do ART or do some Graston or something like that, and they feel like they have a competition on the weekend, and you've just seen them the first time, and you know that you can help them, and that you might have a relationship here over the years or whatever going on. If you can't just challenge them right away, where, you know, I'm not breaking up adhesions, you know, I'm not realigning joints, you know, it's to make them have that shift in an hour if they've felt that way for 10 years because they've seen 10 good therapists over the years. So sometimes I'd say it's okay to go with it a little bit, you know, like just slowly go with it and then slowly try to change them over the years. So it sounds like I'm compromising, but I am compromising because I think it's still for the better in the long run. And then you slowly change their opinions, just like most clinicians' opinions slowly took time to change over time. Does that make sense? That expediency? So sometimes I don't jump right in. But then I would encourage that therapist who can explain the SI joint in terms of without a biomechanical model, that, you know, they have to practice. They have to look and talk to other therapists that do it and find a routine that works for them. You know, to me, I always come back to sensitivity, you know, and that something hasn't adapted and that it needs stress to adapt. It's sensitive for any number of reasons in the person's life. And I can apply that to every joint from an ankle to a follicle. I don't chew off follicles.
To a cat?
Yeah. I want to treat my own to grow some, but other than that.
That's funny. Funny you said somebody passed along a video on Facebook. I don't know if you saw it. It was, I think it was somewhere on the Asian side of the world. And it was a hairdresser. And he finished out the hair appointment with a cat fluffing the guy's hair.
Oh, that sounds like a euphemism for something else.
It does, but it was... Actually, literal cat. He was holding
not
a literal
kind of,
cat.
Not that kind of Asian ending.
Yes. It was an actual kitten.
Cat fluff, sir? Oh, sure. Yeah, they do that here. We have vibrators. Wait, like the thumper? We have our hairdressers on vibrators. No, they have hand vibrocusters. Have you seen these things? Old school barbers?
Is this only in Ontario?
No, this is
what kind of haircuts do you get in Canada?
Swing line. It's all like shoulders and up. After they cut your hair, they'll take this hand percussor. It's like a thumper, like a vibrating, and they put it on your shoulders and neck and back. I was thinking of buying one before and rebranding it.
Nice. Sounds like something I'll do. The edge percussor.
Edge vibrofascial function.
Kinetic. Edge ending.
Edge ending, yeah.
I would love to see some research on that, Greg.
Hey, you know, that makes people happy, make them feel bad.
I used to do like ART passes with a vibe. I keep on saying vibrator with a thumper. And then a friend of mine, he actually created a technique called FiberMax Therapeutics. And it's like active release technique with a one ball vibrating thing on his hand.
I'm trying to imagine that right now.
Sphere vibrating,
perfectly sensitive. It seems like it would just ruin his, you know, make his hand extra sensitive. I don't know. I wouldn't want to hold that thing all day.
Oh yeah, they're crazy. That's how I wake my kids up. A quick vibrating ball to their head.
Nice.
Vibrating sphere.
That seems like it would be tough to sleep through. I'll have to try that with my daughter.
Dr. Ho, like a quick, I cranked up TENS machine, thrown on their abs. Get up and
makes them tougher, right? When we were in PT school, Joe and I would test out the Easton machine on each other. And I remember one day Joe had a sinus issue, so we said, you know, it's a natural progression to test the power of the Easton. So we put it on the sinuses on his face and cranked it up. And before you hear the end of that story, whether Joe's face explodes or not, let's hear from WebPT, the end-to-end business solution for private practice PTs, OTs, and SLPs, providing everything from documentation and scheduling to RCM services, billing software, and now outcomes. WebPT provides a free monthly webinar to educate providers on being better in practice and business. In the beginning, I told you I sat down with Dr. Heidi Janenga, the co-founder and president of WebPT, to learn more. So I asked her, hey, Heidi, the topic of your webinar this month is outcomes. How does this impact our profession and our care? What will people learn if they tune in? Why are outcomes so important?
Thanks so much, Gene. As healthcare reform pushes providers to deliver better care at a lower cost, the ability to prove our value as a profession is absolutely critical. That's why I'm betting on outcomes. In this month's free webinar, I'll explain what outcomes tracking is, why you should care, and most importantly, how you can start tracking and leveraging outcomes now. To join in on the conversation, register at webpt.com/value.
Thanks, Heidi. Again, check out webpt.com/value. Outcomes are the future. You definitely want to check that out for a free webinar. And now, back to Therapy Insiders and our story of putting electrical stimulations on Joe's face, and let's hear if it exploded or not. Spoiler alert, it didn't work.
Oh jeez, I thought it worked for everything. Hey Greg, let me ask you, because you actually every time I used to actually post a video that said something about release, even though I wasn't releasing, and you would always jump on my back about actually using the word release. Actually changed the entire last year. I rebranded all my release techniques as inhibition techniques. And I basically say it's because of you that I call them positional inhibition or functional inhibition, because we're not really releasing it. You know, I'm like taking it and causing the psoas to fly away free. And I did it because you were jumping on my back about it, but I would always say this is someone from someone who's actually active release certified. Now, did you take those courses before you were – so before, not after?
I took them when I was in Cairo, like in 2003. I had lunch with Leahy. We were going to do a research thing. You know, all my colleagues did it. You know, I almost I did all that stuff. And then I even sort of was going to work with a company, and all they did was ART, so I had to go and follow them along. Yeah, it never made sense to me even back then.
I'm glad it didn't make sense to you, because it made sense to me at the time, because you know why? You get results, right? If you get results, it's got to be true, right? The mechanisms. So when you came across basically fossil deformation research that showed it was nearly impossible by human means, you know, thousands of pounds of force or so, I guess if it never made sense, you didn't have the same problems with that research that I did. Did you or no?
I like the fascia stuff because all those fascia guys still always talk about the nervous system a little bit. So I still thought there might have been something there. Like I was in for 3 months into really pressing hard. Like I believed in mechanotransduction. So I started reading Carlos Stecco's stuff. You know, I thought maybe I will press hard and just really, really, really dig. And what I thought I was doing was just like strength training. Maybe I didn't think I deformed anything translatively at the time, but I thought maybe it was a stimulus to create an adaptation. You know, so I thought maybe it was mechanical transduction. And I'm still open to that model. That is still possible. I mean, I challenge people to give an example, because I always say, can you create mechanotransduction from an external stimuli? Like, if you rub on something really hard, will it get bigger, you know, or you adapt?
Only for a while, and then it actually gets smaller.
So, yeah, there's a natural history. But I always say, like, if you just rub on your biceps, will it create hypertrophy? You know, so if you rub on a tissue, will it catalyze some change in that tissue to adapt? You know, to get stronger or denser? Will the morphological changes or material changes in the tendon? And, you know, it's not really a lot, but it's plausible. Because the reason it's plausible is because you can have a negative adaptation, right? Like, if your shoes are too tight in the back of your Achilles, you can get a tendinopathy sometime, can't you? Or at least in the tenosynovitis. So if you can have these negative effects from external forces rubbing, you know, perhaps you could have the positive. I don't know. It's one of those areas I'm not sure about.
Right. So when I talk about
I think fascia does adapt. It's just not quick. It's like any other tissue. It'll adapt slowly with load over time. And we shouldn't denigrate it or say it's not important. It's just as important as anything else in the body, and subject to the same laws of adaptation as other tissues.
Right. I just say that the results you're getting within a visit or so are not mechanical, but it doesn't mean they're not happening within 6 weeks or so. It happens probably about the same rate as hypertrophy does, which is to say it happens, but just not quickly.
It could be viscoelastic, though. There will be like temporary changes in tissue that's by viscoelastic. You'll have decreased stiffness and all of that stuff. Because even if we're picky on the inhibition idea, right? Like, you think someone doesn't have range of motion wherever. We assume that something is, the idea is that, well, a muscle's holding on there. But all our research studies, when we look at range of motion, they usually throw an EMG electrode on there and try to control for that. And they don't actually measure any muscle activity, at least in all the stretching studies. So we're not really seeing, like, what I would like to see is a study, if you knock, like, measure someone's range of motion in an SLR and then knock them out, got to be, like, under anesthetic, a general, and then see if the range of motion changes.
Right. I always wanted to see that too, but it doesn't seem practical from our standpoint.
It's not happening.
Not to hijack the podcast with you, but there was, I didn't know if you, you know, Schleip, right?
Yeah.
You're aware of Schleip's research? Did you hear about
his kids, a story, putting him to bed?
Right.
Nothing.
We're good. I heard he did unpublished research that he basically rubbed local anesthesia over one group and did, you know, whatever, soft tissue techniques to the lumbar spine to see if it improved range of motion. Right. And the ones without perception did not actually have any changes versus the ones with perception or awareness had to have changes. So I don't even know if they needed to be actually fully knocked out. I think you could even just locally anesthetize either from just the skin or the muscles. I think you're probably not going to get the effect because there's no awareness. So I think that is a way to improve, but no one has done it in a published fashion. I mean, I even have colleagues who've done it with an edge tool and with local anesthesia. And it showed that it didn't do anything on the ones with local anesthesia. And, you know, I think that's consistent with my message.
No, I'm just wondering if range of motion is always limited because there's muscle activity. Like when you get up on the stress strain curve and you have your SLR at 80 degrees, how much muscle activity in the hamstrings is fighting that?
Right.
How much is passive?
Just stretch perception.
Yeah, but that just lets you tolerate the pain, right? If you have less muscle activity, then your stiffness will change. The stress strain curve will shift. If you can tolerate the pain, you get more into motion. The stiffness will just be the same thing. Like those studies on stretching, they look at, you know, muscle stiffness in that way. And I'm wondering, because what you're saying is if you do any manual therapy technique, right, you're saying that the muscle becomes inhibited and the nervous system lets it go farther. Is it just because they're tolerating more pain, or are you saying that there's less muscle activity in that muscle fighting that movement?
Yeah, I never looked at it from a muscle activity standpoint. Because I just don't have EMG. What I'm saying is you're changing the perception of stretch or the neurotag associated with a particular movement just via modulatory means you know, any technique, whether it's scraping or compression wrapping or joint mobilizations. I mean, you're still just providing like a competing proprioceptive stimulus and then possibly changing the neurotag that's associated with a movement or position.
And then they're able to tolerate more discomfort as you push it farther up.
Right. Or there's no longer discomfort because that neurotag is removed because you provided enough of like a whatever bombardment, you know, proprioceptive bombardment.
Yeah. So that's the stretch tolerance idea.
Yeah. Yes. That's kind of my working idea for why things work.
Yeah. That's not really that amazing, you know, because that came out in 1996, just so you know.
Yeah.
Shut down.
I didn't say I invented it. I didn't even say it was recent.
Had it been me, I would have told you about that.
so going back,
right, we're the person who got me thinking about that.
The overall goal, I think that all of us can agree on, is when somebody comes to see us, whether they're in pain or even not, sometimes is to get them back to doing something, and that usually or should entail loading, right? I think regardless of what techniques or things that you believe in, I think most PTs, and I'll say most because there's always, you know, 9 out of 10 dentists, the same thing, 9 out of 10 physical therapists believe in loading people as soon as they can. And sometimes some PTs or physios baby their patients a little bit more and some a little bit less. But in the end, it all comes down to loading and Ersin novel inputs. So with loading as a goal or should be a goal, and all the different interventions that have been proposed and shown and taught, Aaron Perez asked Greg, if with all these things out there, have you found commonalities with interventions that you use or that are mainstream or that are taught often or talked about? Have you seen little bits of commonality between all of them to use in the clinic?
Yeah, I do. This is what I think they all do, like sort of a McKenzie MDT, a Maitland, a McGill, a Sermon. You know, they sort of break up a habit. You know, they find something that someone can't do, that has trouble doing, and they figure out a way that they can start doing something similar to it. There's some sort of symptom modification going on. If they can't get down to the floor, you know, Stu would have them, you know, it might be a neutral position. You know, they're not flexing their back. They'll change the position of the knee to do it. They find some way to get someone moving, right? And then they give that patient some sort of power to do that repeatedly. Like, they'll give homework. And so they all end up leading to building self-efficacy and more locus of control in the patients. And then they've sort of given that patient confidence, you know, that they can adapt. And then they start doing these exercises at home that reinforce that adaptability, and they start stressing themselves a little bit more, a little bit more, and a little bit more. That's what I think that they all do, is they really change symptoms some way to get someone doing something. So there's like that patient buy-in, and then the homework kind of mimics that. And you could even see that in neurodynamics. So you have a positive slump test. Okay, so that's the thing that hurts. Well, now when you do that slumping motion, just lift your head up instead. Oh, that takes the pain away. Okay, awesome. So look how you have control over that. Now go home and do that every hour, right? And guess how we're going to progress this load from a slider where you're getting relief. Now we're going to progress the load. You're going to start doing a tensioner. Now you're stressing into something that was once really painful, and look, you're handling it more, and we're stressing more and stressing more. Okay, now we're going to make this make your exercises more meaningful. So doing a slider, that's just silly. What do you want to do in your life that you're not doing? Okay, now we'll start stressing that. Go start guarding more, bend over, pick up your kids, all of those things. I think they all do variants of that. And some have hands on, hands off, it doesn't matter. There's always something there. And they sell the shit out of it.
And that's crucial, because the importance is getting them to a positive end goal when they're done. And whether that's, like you said, through doing things within their system or not, it's essentially, if there's no research behind it, you can say it's the positive use or it's placebo. with a positive outcome and the locus of control, but it essentially comes down to psychology a lot of times, and modifying the environment, giving the locus of control, and doing it in an expert type of way that the patient gets to where they need to go. So the follow-up to that is, if you have 6 weeks to do, and if in 6 weeks the person's going to get better, does it matter how those 6 weeks are spent?
Oh, so if they're going to get better, no matter what they do?
Yeah, if they're going to get better in 6 weeks, whether it's Maitland or any of the approaches that you mentioned, if they come
in. It doesn't matter. That's why it's great when people have different ways to do it. It's so probably when you have a different training and different backgrounds, and if you can think of what the common denominators are, then you can be more flexible to try to figure out whatever's going to resonate with that patient for that 6 weeks. So you got to find something that's going to work for them. You know, I don't think it matters. That's why pitting systems against systems doesn't make sense. We're not going to see too much unless the system's drastically different. And that's why I like the cognitive functional therapy guys. So they have their biomechanical system, but they're also really trying to bring in the cognitions and the pain science and addressing the multidimensional nature of pain. So that's why, I mean, my bias is toward those guys, because they're really going after everything that might help.
Research is, I'm sure, to many clinicians' chagrin, pretty much agreeing on that. It doesn't matter what exercise you choose. It doesn't matter which manual technique you choose. The patient seems to get better when they do multi-center studies with no basic. It's not just like a McKenzie study or a Maitland study or a core stabilization study. It seems like the people who are going to get better, And that's why, I still have yet to review it. He talked about it. And last time I talked about it with Joe Brentz, it was unpublished, but Chad Cook has done that research, basically identifying that 80 to 90% of people, no matter how long they've had pain for a chronic low back pain population, they're just ready to get better. They're just, you know, he just said their nervous system is in a readiness state that they're going to get better no matter what you do to them. It still has to be, I think, novel and skillfully and empathetically provided.
Yeah, it's just finding out what those other things are that create that are the catalyst for that. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, people also make emotional connections to techniques because you spend so much time learning them and money, and you hang out with these people, and when somebody says or challenges in any way, it's instead of discussing the principle of the techniques, you discuss the emotional aspect of why are you challenging me? And once you start going down that road, nothing good ever happens.
Yeah, I know. That's why I don't talk about NKT online.
Yes, that is... They sure get upset. And it is something that I always say at my seminars. I'm not saying you're not successful, because obviously none of us would be here if we just had shitty outcomes day after day after day. I'm just saying that it's just probably not doing what you're saying it's doing. That's it. That's how I say it.
I say the exact thing.
Oh, really? I imagine that you'd say it meaner.
No. No way, then you lose them. Because if you want to, you know, I think I'm only rougher with my friends. If people who are that far gone, I would be more delicate. If you really want to change people's opinion, you can't just tell them they're wrong. They'll put too many walls up. That's the problem sometimes with some of the online stuff. But people who want to change people's opinions, they do it too harshly. It doesn't work. It's not going to help anybody.
Well, it eventually worked on me. I just did hear it a couple of times. But it's hard. You get emotionally attached to these things, you know, especially if, I mean, someone in my seminar, I can't say who it was because he just went through F-camp training, but he basically said, if you really apply the research toward even a manual therapy certificate program, much less a whole fellowship program, there really wouldn't be like 8 levels of seminars. There'd only be 1 or 2 seminars.
Oh, yeah. I know, I said it a long time before him.
Oh, he might have been quoting. He might have been saying, that's what you're talking about.
I've been saying that. I have a little lecture on manual therapy in my course, and it's one research paper, which probably cuts in half or 80% most of the manual therapy techniques, and just saying these aren't doing what they're saying, just based on this one research paper.
Yeah, you know, five or six years ago, it drove me nuts when one of my fellows, who eventually he went to study under Joel Bielowski, he basically presented me with research that said, the average PT student, when they practiced lumbar manipulation for 2 hours, became just as proficient at it and had the same results as, like, you know, experienced clinicians. And I was like, what? And now I'm just like, oh, yeah. Okay.
Yep. Throw him on the side, hit him with your chest.
How about we finish out with a question from Matthew Boyd at M. Boyd Physio. He says, just ask him about stretching, and he'll go on from there. So, I think
already shut me down about stretching.
Yes, we've talked about stretching quite a few times on this podcast, and we each have our unique perspectives on it. Is there any benefit to stretching?
The reason I talk about stretching is because it's a good example of challenging your own biases. So in the 90s, I thought it was ridiculous that there's no reason to do it. Yeah. I thought, so I went out of my way looking for research to give reasons not to stretch, you know? And so the idea that it changed stiffness in the long term, I found papers showing that it didn't, you know, the idea that it didn't prevent injuries. And then there was that little bit of research showing that strength, you know, was decreased after you stretched. But then, and if you really challenge those ideas, you can find the strength idea is, it's really not that much of a strength loss. And it's only during really simple tasks, and only if you're stretching for more than 60 seconds, like static holds. And then that strength loss doesn't last that long. And maybe that strength loss doesn't even occur in a high performance sport where it's complicated actions. So that strength loss isn't even a big deal. And then I said, well, it doesn't do anything to the muscles. Well, there's a number of research papers that actually show that it does. Kubo from 2002 shows changes in stiffness. And then now there's a crazy paper from Kubo as well. This is nuts. Hold on. Long-term stretching. Over 6 weeks, there's a few papers show improvements in performance, strength, power, jumping, running speed, all this stuff. Makes no sense. Stretching makes you stronger and faster. But the idea, why it might do that is long-term stretching at the level of the tendon changes, okay, this is where I'm going to lose everyone, changes the hysteresis loop. It's like a stress strain curve where you load up the tendon and then you unload the tendon. On that unloading part, which would be like, if you're going to do a vertical jump, you go down, that's the loading, and then the unloading is jumping back up, like releasing the spring. That part is stiffer. Isn't that mind-blowing? Long-term stretching will make that part of the curve on the hysteresis loop, on the unloading part, the releasing the spring part, stiffer, so you actually get less energy lost as heat and more returned into the joint. Isn't that nuts?
Stop stretching talking craziness.
That's crazy.
I find this really interesting because this seems like something I would have been attracted to 10 years ago.
It's so counterintuitive.
Were the athletes only stretching? They had no other change in program? Or were they also – so they were stretching or in addition to like their normal training?
So they've done both. They've done this as in performance. When they have people stretch and it changes performance, they also just done it at the level of the tendon. So the basic science research, and then they have the on-the-ground research. And then there's also a great review from McHugh saying, you know, people are saying it doesn't prevent injuries, but that's only all injuries. If you just look at muscle injuries, the stretch shortening type injuries, stretching before activity, this paper is done by Malachi McHugh, Bem, I can't remember Bem's first name, worked with Digby Sale, whatever, and one other guy, their last lit review said, no, if you just segregate the injuries to muscle injuries, there actually might be a decrease in injury risk for static stretching before activity. Isn't that nuts, dude? Well, yes.
Get out of here with your crazy research talk.
I fell into this bias of I didn't want to like stretching. So I went on my way to find all the stuff showing against it. And if you look better at the research, which I started to do a couple years ago, you know, and challenged my own belief, I said, oh, it's not so bad. I'm still not going to stretch.
Me either. I read that blog post too, when you basically went over all of that. And I thought, oh, should I start stretching? It's pretty cool though.
I am going to stretch because I'm going to be doing back handsprings next year. So I'll stretch for that. Anyways, enough about me.
I would love to see a video of that.
Me doing a standing back tuck. It's on my Facebook page. Yeah, my daughter's cheerleading. They said, bring a friend. I was like, want to be my friend? And I went to like the 7-year-old cheerleading, tumbling around, and I was doing stuff on the ground. I didn't have a mustache at the time.
I was thinking maybe you're on the tumble track. You're not on the tumble track? You're really on the ground?
No, right on the ground. And I did it on a mat, so I couldn't even jump. I did it on a mat, so I didn't even have like a good vertical leap. And I made it most of the way around.
And you're not paralyzed?
No, not that I know of.
Good for you. Well done.
All right. Well,
I'm impressed. We get
girls that.
Yeah.
We've got a bunch of girls in gymnastics as well.
All right. Well,
Gene, not what you expected on stretching.
It is and it isn't. I've been reading up a little bit. I told you in the beginning of this podcast, I've been reading more. For some unknown reason, I've read some research. And yeah, I've seen some interesting things. Still wouldn't do it, like Greg's thought. Because I think still the
we have no reason to do it.
The reason, but I still think the time spent doing it could be better spent doing other things.
Oh, like, yeah, totally.
Like me drinking coffee.
Which also improves performance in
some ergogenic sports.
Well, that's just the psychology of it. They smell the coffee, they feel better, and the outcome improves. So, more than the stretching. So
I have to drink it, though. I don't know. It's just not the smell isn't enough.
Are you kidding me? In the morning, you smell the coffee, your day just gets better right away.
It does. It gets even better when I drink it.
Well, true, but that's gratification. That's confirming your smell. All right. Well, and any final questions for Greg before we let him go to do more flips and such?
Yeah. Do you keep up with your ART certificate?
I haven't from 12 years ago. No.
Oh, I see. I thought you kind of kept on re-upping it.
No, no more releasing for me. I said the only releasing I do is doves at weddings. Boom.
Wait, did you just shoot them? Did you release them and then just shoot them?
It's horrific.
Toronto, you can't shoot doves.
For some reason, I just pictured, do you remember Face Off with Nicolas Cage and John Travolta? There was like that big scene where they, at the cemetery, having that final shootout and just doves fly out everywhere.
Or just when like Greg walks into a room before he starts teaching, it's like slow motion with doves flying.
Boom. That's going to be, I can already imagine the name of this podcast, the title, Vibrators, Doves, and Stretching with Greg Lehman.
That's good.
Maybe cats in there too.
All right.
Dead cats. Or bunny.
Or bunny. Either one. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Greg. I know we covered a lot of stuff, interesting stuff that I think most of our listeners will enjoy. And if they want to follow your blog or any of the stuff that you put out, where can they find you?
I just switched. It's just greglehman.ca. And I'm teaching a lot in the States if anyone wants to come.
Yeah, man. Where are you going to be?
Well, this weekend it's Arizona, but that's all full. And then I'm in L.A., Seattle at the end of February, Philadelphia, and then a couple times in B.C. And if anyone listens in Canada, I'm in London. So can't.
Sweet.
No one knows me in Canada.
Okay.
No, that's not true. Most of the people I always name drop in Canada, and people know who you are.
That's good. They don't like me then.
Way to point it out that nobody likes Greg in Canada, Urson. Way to go.
No, I'm just talking to the right people. They all love Greg's message.
Are all your courses on the website?
Yeah, the schedule is there.
Okay, perfect. So check out Greg's course schedule. The blog, we'll post all that on our webpage, updocmedia.com.
Oh, and get my free pain workbook. That thing's still free, and we're gonna redo it this year. It's gonna be awesome, and it'll still be free. I promise.
Sweet,
it's awesome. Yeah,
my favorite
It's like explain pain. And then I went to Why Do I Hurt, which was even cheaper. And then Greg just basically wrote a free version. And I'm like, dang, there goes my idea for a $4.99 version. So I give it to all my patients. It's a great resource. We'll link it.
Yeah, I've never read Widewire. I've been meaning to.
It's great. It just has a bunch of different analogies. I think it might be a little bit better than Explain Pain. But I use the fracture, you know, the initial fracture, and then you're still fractured the entire time you're in a cast, one from your book all the time on people, except for people who have never fractured something, because I was like, oh, well, there goes my great analogy.
Yeah. Hey, you want to know something? You know that Kevin Ware picture where his leg bone goes through the skin? I'm good at anatomy, eh? It's below when you look down on your right.
Yeah, that one.
That bone in the skin. That's a perfect example of nociception not equaling pain and blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure he had nociception. I think he might have had initial, like, A delta firing there. But why would he have nociception? I bet if you moved it around, he would have had some pain. Right? You can have a fracture and not have pain. You can have a laceration and not have pain. That doesn't prove that nociception doesn't equal pain. That proves that maybe sometimes there's no nociception. You can have damage without nociception. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, like the guy who was having mild headaches intermittently, and he complained to his doctor, and they finally MRI'd him. He had like a nail in his brain, and he remembered. They're like, oh, yeah, like 2 years ago, I dropped a nail gun, and I thought nothing happened, but it like shot up through his nose and went, was like stuck in his brain.
So definitely damage in that case. Definitely damage with Kevin Ware. So we can't use that picture to say nociception doesn't equal pain. That just says damage doesn't equal nociception.
So yeah. I have a 3.5-year-old son, and he, like,
don't
he,
test this on him.
He hates, he, I don't have to. I mean, it's life. What do you mean test it on him? he hates little cuts on his hands. Like, he hates cuts, right? So he freaking ran into the wall the other day. Like, we were having the sword fight or something, and he turns around and runs. And it's like one of those comedy movies where they don't know the wall's there and turns, and he just rams like full steam ahead into the wall, stands up, picks up his play sword, and goes at it again. He gets a little tiny cut on his finger, and it's the end of the world. And I'm thinking, like, how is this possible that you just freaking went 100 miles an hour into the wall and didn't even blink? And I know that had to hurt. Like, we have hardwood floors and then fairly sturdy walls. We have a late 50s house that's, you know, built solid. And then he gets like a tiny cut on his hand, and it's literally the sky's falling. Awesome. All right, Greg, thanks for joining us, man. We'll definitely link to everything that you've mentioned, the pain book and your site and the courses. And if you're ever on the East Coast in the Maryland, New York area, let us know. Come hang out.
Yeah, Maryland / New York area. Yeah.
All the same.
We'll bring our needles.
All right. I'll come hang out with your clinic next time I'm in Toronto, which I visit my family there a lot. So.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks for tuning in to Therapy Insiders. Hope you enjoyed that podcast and interview with Greg Lehman. We had a lot of fun doing it, covered so much stuff. If you want to hear anything else or know anything else, definitely check out Greg's blog or find him on social media. Not Too Hard is pretty prevalent. Or reach out to us, as always, on updocmedia.com or tweet at us at Therapy Insiders, at the OMPT or at JoeDPT. I'd be happy to engage with you about this episode. If you want to hear the inside scoop on this episode, follow me on Periscope at Therapy Insiders for the Beyond the Podcast weekly in-depth perspective. Also, check us out on iTunes. Just type in Therapy Insiders or look at podcast, the medical section. We're usually in the top of the charts. We really, really could use your reviews and ratings because they help us stay on top of those charts, and your listens and feedback are crucial to us because we're always trying to improve and listen to you to hear who you want to hear on this podcast. So as always, thank you so much for tuning in. Catch you on the Periscope, Beyond the Podcast, and next week on Therapy Insiders. Have a good week.